Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thank you so much, Professor Tandon. Thank you, of course, to Morton, yet again, here again in this august institution. Thank you to the Center for International Law Research and Policy, to its collaborating institutions on this important event, to Professor Stan for the invitation to participate. As with other speakers, I should make clear at the beginning, I'm here in my capacity as a research fellow for the Center for International Law Research and Policy. My remarks do not reflect the positions intended or otherwise of the World Bank Group or the United Nations Development Program. In saying that, I'm going to look at, I'm going to consider in justifying why aiding and abetting should be considered a critical exaggerating factor in determining gravity in preliminary examinations based on our findings in a key background paper that will inform the joint flagship study of the World Bank and the United Nations on conflict prevention. The background study considered 119 transitions and made statistically significant findings about the impact of different transitional justice processes on conflict recurrence or non-recurrence. We used a 3 and a 5 year horizon to test, including prosecutions of core international crimes cases. And we found that where high-level actors are prosecuted in a situation post-conflict, the likelihood of conflict recurrence increases by 65%. Where mid-level and low-level alleged perpetrators are prosecuted, the likelihood of conflict recurrence decreases by 70%. So, we don't, these are very obviously significant findings in our field, having worked in the area of transitional justice for over a decade now. As many of you know, we often proceed based on the assumption that to pursue those bearing greatest responsibility or those most responsible is not just virtuous, but shapes behavior, right? And so I would put forward here today that the very much what the high-level panel put to the United Nations itself when it conducted what is commonly known as the HIPPO review of United Nations conflict resolution and peacebuilding practice, which is to say that the primary objective of the United Nations should be political settlement, peaceful resolution, and as we see in Sustainable Development Goal 16 now, just, inclusive, and sustainably peaceful societies. So what does that mean for international criminal law and its enforcement? And for our purposes, what does that specifically mean for preliminary examination and the determination of which conduct should be emphasized, why, and how we select specific episodes of such conduct. And I think to consider this issue, it's important to go back to one of Professor Bergsmo's other important projects, which is the historical foundations of international criminal law. And I think when we chart the trajectory of this field, I note that Mr. Cayley said yesterday, you know, we have come so far so fast, but in doing what, right? And I think when you chart the trajectory of this activity, particularly from 1945, and where the vast majority of consensus, or the consensus really was about establishing an international criminal court to prosecute the crime of aggression, right? The crime of all crimes. And I think the push of that conduct to the periphery of focus in international criminal law in the post-Cold War era demands that those that do have agency, like those in the prosecution of the ICC, should seek to employ the discretion that they do have to emphasize such conduct. And I think because the mode of liability of aiding and abetting enables prosecution de facto of the conduct of waging war by proxy, demands that this should be, particularly where we have external actors to a conflict, driving or enabling conduct that violates international humanitarian law. This should be the focus. This should be a critical element, not just in interpreting gravity, but also in interpreting the interests of justice. When we look to global peace and security, what are the key drivers? What are the key elements that inform our capacity to prevent? And when we look back to the organization of the United Nations, institutions such as this here, designed for the peaceful resolution of interstate conflict, my proposal to you is that we return to an orientation that prioritizes state sovereignty over the easily manipulated intervention of which I would argue the International Criminal Court plays a role. And I have approximately 4 or 5 minutes left, so what I wanted to do was to just take you through
8 minutes.
Very generous. Was just take you through a couple of situations where I think this approach could be of significant utility for deterring the most nefarious behavior, the behavior by the most powerful states, those same states that have played the most prominent role and the most influential role in shaping what can be prosecuted and by which institutions, right? And so, as I mentioned in one of the questions to one of the panelists yesterday, I think Colombia is a particularly instructive case here, where you have, as a matter of public policy, the provision of over $1 billion in lethal support to a party to a conflict that for decades consistently has committed crimes. Now, of course, this is a situation where the jurisdiction over the conduct of on the territory informs the culpability of a non-state party. However, others yesterday referred to the situation in Syria. And I think, of course, it's particularly topical, but where you require, in terms of mens rea, and I must thank our colleague Matthew for bringing to my attention a couple of cases and a couple of instructive articles for interpreting this component, that a level of near certainty may constitute the evidential threshold for determining aiding and abetting before the ICC. And potentially the argument put forward by the Office of the Prosecutor may be, well, this is a very high bar. But I would nonetheless argue that despite that, it is incumbent on the prosecution of the ICC, given the severe impact of this behavior of in prompting conflict, conflict that we know is generally accompanied by violations of international humanitarian law, it is incumbent upon the prosecution to test where this boundary lies, particularly in relation to more powerful actors. And if we look at Syria, we see all sorts of attempts to enable jurisdictions that might prosecute conduct in Syria. And if we look at this through the prism of this mode of liability of aiding and abetting, then all of a sudden we have key global powers supporting various parties to the conflict, key regional powers supporting various parties to the conflict, with the knowledge that those actors that they have been supporting have a consistent record of perpetrating core international crimes there in Syria. So I would say the very first step is to be much more diligent and at least place front and center this conduct in its annual reporting to the Assembly of States Parties. I will say in my paper for the anthology that this is an inexcusable omission on the part of the Office of the Prosecutor's practice to ring fence these conflicts, given what we know about conflict, given the publicly available information that in many situations it is a matter of public policy that that governments provide material support to these domestic actors. And of course, I'll consider by putting back to some of the participants in this conference the situation in Iraq, which came under particular scrutiny yesterday. I think we had three different panelists speak to that particular case. And my concern is that the practice of states, which has informed the practice of the International Criminal Court, is now also informing the significant omission on the part of us, right? Those in academia. We are supposed to be here to be holding these institutions to account, and in my view, we are derelict in omitting to scrutinize the criminal liability of the key players most able to drive conflict, the very conflict that we purport to scrutinize and hold institutions that hold these people to account. So, so this is my thesis that that in academia we can take the first step by demanding that this these considerations are more rigorous. First of all, that they occur. And then I think we can also make the case that the deterrent effect of doing so, of course, in the World Bank UN study, we find because we have sufficient cases, you know, to examine that there is this relationship between the prosecution of core international crimes cases and conflict non-recurrence. Of course, when these international organizations consider what works and what doesn't in terms of practice for conflict prevention, we can only look at what has happened, right? So we have a serious problem, and that logic would inform us that for conflict prevention, we should consider the impact of prosecuting the illegal conduct of waging war. But of course, because we do not have sufficient cases, you know, we can't use our regressions to make statistically significant findings. I believe I should be right on the mark. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.